Okay, so now that should be on. I'm going to talk today about more or less the thermal evolution of the Earth, and I'm going to keep this fairly broad in a sense, fairly much focused on general principles as much as possible. And I will even go through some of the equations and where they come from, and talk a little bit about what the various constraints are in the heat budget. We've heard a little bit about this already, sort of in both directly and indirectly, and then talk a little bit about some of the things that go into thermal evolution, and then finally I'm going to end up with a planetary perspective, which is may sound a little bit odd for a workshop on the transition zone, but bear with me because I'll try and tie it all together at the end here. So just to get us started here, basically the Earth, we can think of it, if you work on mantle convection, we think of the Earth as being a heat engine. Essentially, the job of mantle convection is to get the heat out of the Earth. And in so doing, it gives us things like plate tectonics, volcanoes, earthquakes. It gives us all of the nice things that attracted us to becoming Earth scientists. And the energy, basically the power that's available to do that, the total global heat flow today is 44 terawatts. That's roughly speaking how much is coming out of the Earth right now. And I found that when I use that number, terawatts, 44 terawatts, it's hard to relate to that in our everyday life, right? A light bulb might be 100 or 150 watts. Okay, so what does 44 terawatts mean? Well, so I've assembled a few other numbers just so you can get a kind of feel for what this number is. Maybe you can get a feel for what this number is. And actually, this question came into play when people were originally trying to understand mantle convection, what was the driving force, and some energetic arguments had to be made about what could drive plate tectonics and what couldn't drive plate tectonics. So the sun, which is beating down on us, is radiating energy on us, and that all is basically that heats up the atmosphere and then is re-radiated to space at a rate of 180,000 terawatts. So that's a gigantic number compared to the amount of heat coming out of the interior of the Earth. Kind of interesting to see that. On the other sort of end of the spectrum, the tides, the dissipation of rotational energy through tides, is generating about 3 terawatts. And earthquakes are generating about 0.3 terawatts. What does that even mean? So this is a energy per unit time. Well, this basically means if you sort of sum up some kind of average rate of energy release and then divide it by time, you get this number. So it doesn't naturally, I mean, we don't naturally think of earthquakes as in this kind of unit, but it's kind of interesting. And then I find this number particularly interesting. Human beings in producing power, electrical power, nuclear, coal, oil, et cetera, are using about 12 terawatts currently. So when you compare that number to the number that is driving all of geological activity and plate tectonics, mantle convection, volcanology, the dynamo, everything, they're not that different. I just find that fascinating. Yeah. Interesting that you should ask that question. So you might ask where we measure that, how we measure that. So I'm not going to put error bars on it, but I'm going to talk for a minute about how it's measured. And the way heat flow is measured is by a series of point measurements made throughout the world. And so this is from a global compilation of heat flow measurements. And each one, and it's a little fuzzy, but each one of these red dots is basically a heat flow measurement. And these are made in a way that is somewhat conceptually actually fairly simple. Heat flows from hot to cold, right? If you have, many of you have a coffee cup in your hand, you know that your hand is cooler than the coffee mug, and so heat is flowing from the coffee mug to your hand. And conduction, in particular, is one of the main ways that heat moves through at the very surface. So what people do is put a probe into the interior of the Earth in some way, and then measure the temperature gradient. And the heat flow due to conduction is proportional, linearly proportional to the temperature gradient. And there's a proportionality constant that is a property of the rock. And so that allows us to calculate the heat flow at any of these locations. So just to think about this a little bit, what do you notice about the distribution of these points? Sorry? Mostly ocean. Anything else? Mostly developed world. These mostly plate margins. Well, yeah. So actually, this is one. I think this is one of the interesting things about these. I'm not an expert on these measurements, by the way, but not at all. But one of the things I always find fascinating about this is that this is a measurement that is taken more readily, in some fashion, in the ocean basins than it is on land. Okay, so that's a kind of curious thing. You think of most things as being harder to do at the bottom of the ocean than they would be to do on land. But in the case of heat flow measurements, that's not necessarily true. Can anybody think of what would create a problem? If I was going to go out here to, well, not the beach, maybe to the middle of campus and stick a probe in the ground and make a measurement of the temperature gradient, what would be the problems I might encounter in using that to interpret, say, mantle heat flow? Sorry? Yeah, there'd be water. I mean, there's hydrothermal circulation. There's actually even irrigation. When we move out to the middle of campus, you've got water being poured on the top of it from an irrigation system, and that's percolating through the ground and perhaps changing the temperature. Santa Barbara's a kind of difficult place to pick for this, but what if I moved to, let's say Minnesota and tried to make that measurement? There you go. 180,000 terawatts of heat from the sun, seasonal variations, right? So basically on the land, we have that sun coming in, the solar heat coming in, heating up the ground seasonally, daily, and over time. There's a very strong time-dependent signal in the surface heat, in the surface temperature, and that propagates into the interior and makes it difficult. Now, in the ocean basins, that's less true because basically the water at the bottom of the ocean tends to be more uniform temperature. It's not tends to be very uniform temperature. It's not influenced so directly, so immediately, so seasonally by these by the solar, by the seasons, by the change in days, etc. So essentially, in order to make measurements on land, you have to either go deeper, or you have to go deeper than you do in the ocean basins. You have to set up a more elaborate system to deal with these seasonal and changes even at the ice age scale. So all of that signal has to be removed. There's actually an active research program that uses those seasonal variations and the longer term variations due to changes in the climate, and uses the variations in temperature with depth, the propagation of the differences in temperature on the surface into the interior, to extract information about the change in temperature with time, essentially to study climate change over time. It's all direct. You can make direct measurements of temperature and then extrapolate out to what the surface temperature was, which is sort of an interesting thing, because basically what's noise to us, what's the sort of pesky noise to us, is actually someone else's signal, right? So, you know, it's all a matter of your perspective, whether what you're looking at is signal or noise, right? So anyway, taking these measurements and extrapolating them, this is a spherical harmonic representation of the global heat flow based on all those points. And you can see that there's a fair amount of variability here in the global heat flow. And a lot of it is, again, associated with plate boundaries, in particular ocean ridges, right, mid-ocean ridges. So essentially where the hot material from the mantle comes up, it's losing a lot of heat, and that heat is showing up in this global heat flow map. So I think I'm not going to talk much about this because Carolina touched on it, and I don't want to repeat what she said. But if we look at this sort of map and if we look at this map, you can see that basically the younger the younger parts of the ocean floor, the younger parts of the plate, are tend to be hotter than the colder parts. And so there's basically an age relationship between heat flow and age. And this is this work has been studied extensively by a variety of people. Carol Stein has done a very systematic study of this and made plots like this, which have reduced a lot of data to a more simpler view here, which basically shows you the heat flow in milliwatts per meter squared as a function of age. And you can see these very large uncertainties on this, but the global average here comes out. And we'll give if you multiply that by the surface, if you integrate this over the surface area of the Earth, you get that 44 terawatts. So there is some uncertainty in that, but you get that that 44 terawatts. And in fact, is there a question? No. In fact, you can also then create some models of, and I won't really go into this in detail either, but you can create some models of the spreading center and how it cools over time, and reproduce this change in heat loss as a function of age of the plate by looking at the cooling of a half space or the cooling of a plate as it moves away from the mid-ocean ridge. And from that you can extrapolate the thickness of the lithosphere. Okay. So, yeah. No, it's based on both oceanic and continental data. So you'd need to integrate over the entire Earth, basically, to get the global average. The failure to model young plate heat flow, this particular model, it's not well modeled. That's essentially because what you're measuring here is a conductive heat flow. And at this point, the heat flow is that apparent heat flow is reduced by the fact that there's a large amount of hydrothermal circulation. And so you have to use other sort of methods to extract the amount of heat that's being carried by convection. Okay. So let's move into a little bit of convection. I'm going to bounce around a little bit here. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the equations that are driving convection, which I said is a heat engine, right? And I think you'll see several variations of these equations depending on what problem people are studying. And so I'm giving you a kind of simplified version. For example, this is an incompressible fluid. So Peter talked last time about a compressible material. And this material has some internal heating and a temperature-dependent viscosity. But I don't have any kind of, these equations don't have any kind of phase changes or anything like that going on in them. And I've written them down here because a lot of kind of classic work uses essentially this version of the convection equations, but also because I thought it would be worthwhile to just take a few minutes, and sorry for those of you that this will be review for, just to take a few minutes to talk about what the origin of these equations are and what all the terms mean. And then when you see more more realistic versions that do include things like phase changes and so on, you'll be able to interpret that as well. So for those of you who for whom this is a basic review, you can do something else, think about something else for a little while. Essentially, the way we derive those equations is by thinking about a simple particle of fluid and thinking about what happens, what goes into and out of this particle of fluid. And so I've defined an x-axis and a z-axis. And I've taken a very small box. I'm just going to do this in two dimensions. Actually, in one case, I'm just going to look at it in one dimension because it's easier to write. And our box is delta x and delta z. Now, this is actually also the kind of thing that you might think about when you're thinking about using a numerical method. You can think of this as being your grid if you want. Okay. So how did we get that simple conservation mass equation for an incompressible fluid? Well, what we did is we looked at the amount of material that is crossing the four walls of the cell. And so I have some velocity in the x direction, u sub x, and I have a velocity in the vertical direction, u sub z. And the amount of material that's flowing across this interface in a period of time, it's called delta t, a period of time delta t, is going to be ux times delta z. And I assume for this that my box is small enough that there's no, that ux is the same along this entire wall. Okay? And the same is true along the top. The amount of material that's flowing in the top there is uz times that length, delta x. And maybe you'd put a delta time in there if you wanted a time as well. Then on the other side, the amount of material flowing out of this box is basically you can think of it as ux delta of delta x, of x times of x plus delta x. Or we can basically expand that out with a little Taylor series expansion and say it's this velocity plus the gradient of the velocity across there, whatever that is, times that length, which gives us the change in velocity across this interval, and that represents the velocity of the material out of there, times that delta z is our velocity out that side. And the same goes for the velocity down at the bottom of the box. And so basically, what we're saying for an incompressible fluid is what goes in must come out. And so we can then add these up, all four contributions in and out of the box, and the arrows are sort of arbitrary, but we can add them up and they have to sum to zero because our fluid is incompressible. We're not gaining any mass, we're not losing any mass. And so when I add those up, I get this term minus this term, and this term minus this term, and that a lot of those terms then drop out, and then I'm left with an equation that looks like this in two dimensions. And so that's two dimensions Cartesian, and that translates, if you're used to vector calculus notation, to this kind of equation. So those are basically the same equation. So if you're not familiar with vector calculus notation, there are a variety of textbooks, and I can refer you to a couple of them that will help you translate between that and that. And in particular, we'll show you how you might write these equations in three dimensions, how you might write these equations in a different geometry, a spherical geometry, an axisymmetric geometry, a cylindrical geometry, any geometry you can think of. This equation looks a little bit different, but it always looks the same when it's reduced to vector notation. So I thought it might be useful for you to see where an equation comes from. Once you've seen where one differential equation comes from, you can start to sort of picture where the other differential equations come from. And so here's another one. So this is basically the heat flow equation, and I don't have all the steps here because, as you can see, it starts to get a little messy. In fact, I've only drawn this out in one dimension just to make it so the slide isn't completely crazy. But again, we have our box of fluid, and we have several possible contributions to the heat content of this little box of fluid. It's got delta x, delta z. And there are several contributions. So one contribution here is the contribution due to conduction. And basically, the amount of heat flowing in this side in an interval delta t is q. Let's call it q. That's just the standard thing we use, qx. And that's multiplied by that length to give us the total heat going across that interface. And I mentioned before that heat flow is proportional to the temperature gradient. So I'm going to substitute in for Q delta T delta X dt dx as a function and multiplied by this constant, the thermal conductivity of the rock or of the material. So as you can imagine, that's a physical property. That's our first introduction of a physical property here. And that's going to depend on what we're working with. If we're working with metal, that's going to be a big number. If we're working with wood, it's going to be a small number. If we're working with rock, it's going to be a fairly small number. So the amount of heat flowing across there is this, and we would then say the amount of heat flowing across there in an interval of time delta t is this times delta t. Moving to the other side, we get that same thing plus the gradients times delta x to give us the change in Q across there times delta z, and it's the same thing. We also, so if we were just doing conduction in a steady state fluid, we would just balance these two and we get a very simple equation. And but we're not, we're just dealing with conduction. We're dealing with as well with convection and with heat production. But I want you to see, I want you to notice this term. So this term and this term look very similar to our mass flow terms, U and U. Except that I'm going to end up with another derivative in there. And so when I do that, it's going to give me a term like that. It's going to give me a second derivative. That's our conduction term. So these two things, basically, when we put them into the balance, are going to add up to that. And we would have similar terms coming out of the top and bottom. And if we were dealing with three dimensions, we'd have similar terms coming in and out of the screen. So in addition to conduction, though, we have the possibility of carrying fluid across. So we have the possibility of convection. And convection is basically just the carrying of heat by motion of the material or motion of the fluid. And so that's going to require a velocity. So now the amount of heat being carried across this interface is the velocity. It depends on the speed at which the stuff is moving. If it's moving fast, it's carrying more heat. If it's moving more slowly, it's carrying less heat. Also, the temperature is a measure of the heat content of the little packet of fluid, and times the density times the heat capacity. That's how we translate the temperature into the heat content of the fluid. And so that is just the heat, the amount of heat being carried across this interface in an interval of time delta t. And again, we have the same, the parallel thing on the other side. This is the amount of heat being carried across this interface, and we could do the same for the top and the bottom in and out. So those terms together, when we add them up and do the heat balance, are going to give us this term. They're going to give us U times the gradient of temperature. Then in when it comes to the mantle, to the Earth, we also have, so if you look at a classic heat flow textbook, you'll probably, this will be more or less where it ends, actually, with one more term. But in our case, we also have the possibility of heat production because there's radioactive decay going on. And so we also have to take that into account. And so I've drawn a term H there. And basically, during an interval of time, depending on how much material we have, how much uranium, thorium, potassium we have in here, there'll be some heat generation going on. And that's going to give us this term on the right. Now, everything here has been normalized and reduced and so on. So it's, instead of being H, it's all done in terms of an internal heating Rayleigh number. But basically, the principles are the same as we just did for the mass balance equation. The other term in here is a delta T, delta time, delta temperature, delta time, change in temperature with time. And that's because I'm not requiring that this be a steady state situation. So unlike the mass balance equations where we can go in and where basically I asserted that I was going to only work with an incompressible fluid, and so there was no gain or loss of mass in the packet of fluid. Here, there can be a gain or loss of heat. Stuff could heat up. It could cool down. And that's going to be represented by this term here. So now you have all of the terms of this equation. You have the change in heat with time. You have what's called an advection term. It's the physical carrying of material that's got some heat content. You have a conduction term, and you have a production, a source term. And so armed with that, you can actually then start solving things. If you want to solve a steady state problem where you can say, I'm not going to let the heat change with time, you can drop that term off and you're left with something else. If you want to solve a conduction problem only, you can pull that term off and work with the rest of it. If you want to solve a problem that has no heat production, you can drop that term off. You can do all sorts of nice stuff. It's also important to notice that we have a coupling between this. This isn't just about temperature. We also need to know the velocities in order to solve this. And so that's going to couple with our next set of equations, which is the momentum force balance equation. So I'm going to do this in three slides, just one for each term as it's written here. But I'm not going to repeat what I just repeated. It's basically the same principle. We have some pressure terms here, some pressure forces, which give rise to this term in this equation. Then we have viscous forces. So because we're dealing with a viscous fluid, we have both we have viscous forces, including shear forces and normal forces, acting on all of these. And again, you have to balance these out, add them up and balance them out, and that will produce this term here. If we were dealing with an inviscid fluid, which is actually what a lot of the sort of mathematics of numerical methods has focused on inviscid fluids, and so their version of these equations is going to be a little bit different from our version of these equations. If we were dealing with an inviscid fluid, it would be a little bit different. But good to remember that these stresses here are going to depend on the viscosity. So if we have a variable viscosity, we have to deal with that in that term. And then finally, in the Earth, we have buoyancy forces, which basically looks nice and simple by comparison on this diagram, because we basically just say, well, gravity's pulling on this. And so we have a force term, G times the mass of the box. So that's, you know, force equals mass times acceleration. And that translates into this. Now, there's a temperature there. Where did that come in? That came in from the fact that our body forces depend on the density, and our density depends on the temperature. Hot material expands, becomes less dense. Cold material contracts, becomes more dense. And in the mantle, we typically treat this with a linear change in density that's quite small, and that has a proportionality constant called the coefficient of thermal expansion, alpha. And so basically the amount of change there is small, a few percent, and that allows us to actually work with this in a fairly simple way. If we had a very large changes in density due to temperature, we would have to modify these equations a little bit. But there are your basic equations there. Again, I haven't included things like changes in I haven't included, there wasn't a heat production term or a heat sink term in the temperature equation due to any solid state phase changes. Right? So if we have a solid state phase change, that's going to affect all of these equations. If we have changes in the viscosity, that's going to affect all of these changes, all of these equations. So when you look at a series of equations in a paper, in a textbook or something, you might want to see whether you can identify what all the terms are. Even if you don't necessarily follow all the derivation of the terms, you might want to see if you can identify what all the terms are and see which ones are the mystery terms that you can't quite identify. Okay, so a brief introduction to the equations of motion. Then we basically are back to our summary here, our three sets of equations plus a viscosity equation. And the way I wrote these, I've basically reduced everything to just a few simple parameters. All the physical properties are buried here, and they're buried in the Rayleigh number, and they're buried in a heat production Rayleigh number. So density, gravity, the thermal expansion coefficient, the thermal diffusivity of the material, how good it is at conducting heat, the viscosity, they're all buried in there, the heat production, and so on, as well as some information about the setup, the geometry. So D here is the length scale associated with our material, our problem, whatever problem it is we're working on. And delta T is the temperature associated with our problem. So we have some material properties buried in here, and we have some other information about the problem buried in here. And so these two parameters in this particular set of equations are going to be the critical ones that are going to govern whether anything happens or not. You can think of the Rayleigh number actually as being a kind of description of how important the buoyancy forces are. They're in the numerator here, rho, g, alpha, delta T. Compared to how important the factors are that are inhibiting convection. So viscosity, for example, would tend to prevent things from moving, and so that goes down here. And so does thermal conductivity. The better something is at conducting heat, maybe the more it tends to suppress convection as a mechanism for getting heat out. And so you can think of this as being a balance between those various factors. Okay, so Rayleigh numbers are tricky, right? So in fact, I'm sort of finessing something that Peter talked about last week a little bit, which is basically that the Rayleigh number is ill-defined when we are dealing with anything other than an isoviscous fluid, or anything where any of these properties vary, actually. because essentially we want to be able to identify a single number. So it would be best if we, in a certain, okay, I can assert this, I'm not sure I really believe this or not, but it might be best if we just drop the whole concept of Rayleigh number when we're dealing with variable viscosity. So the rest of the term here, the rest of this appears essentially in this term. Yes, exactly. Yep, that's right. That's right. Alpha also can vary with depth. So, and we can use rho here. Probably should have been a rho naught. We can use rho here because we assume that it's a small linear dependence on temperature. Is what that rho depends. The density depends only in a sort of small way, linearly on temperature. That's why we can use that in there. So. Actually, and so recently also, people have started to talk, and we touched on this a little bit last week as well. People have started to talk about whether the thermal conductivity or thermal diffusivity vary with depth and vary with what state something's in. So there's some thought that perhaps in the lower mantle, things are better at conducting heat than they are in the upper mantle. And what are the consequences of that? Well, the consequences of that is that we'd have to adjust this term as well and include yet another variable parameter in here. So, okay. The formal kind of mathematical way of doing that would be to write all those things out and then say, let's take the limit as delta x and delta z go to zero, and then we derive the full set of equations. But the nice thing about thinking about those equations from time to time and where they came from is that it also kind of provides an analogy, is that the right word, or a metaphor, for how numerical solutions to them happen. So when we're dealing with solving things using a numerical method, as you saw in the tutorial, you basically start to divide things up into a grid. And I've just done this in the simplest possible way here, as it's kind of schematic. You can think of each of these little squares as being one of those fluid elements. And you can then start to think about what is required to have adequate resolution on your grid. Okay? What might be required is that the gradient of things that you care about, things like temperature, velocity, and so on, are not really large across an individual element. Because typically you are you're calculating an estimate of the temperature on some points. They might be the corners of these elements. They might be somewhere in the interior of these elements, depending on the method. And then we're estimating the temperature, the velocity, and so on everywhere else in each of these little fluid elements using some simple method, either a linear method or some other function, some simple function. And so you want to be sure that you don't have sort of changes in temperature, velocity, and so on as you move across a single element, because that would suggest that your problem is poorly resolved, that your grid is poorly resolved. So, okay. So I'm jumping around a little bit here, but since we talked, and it's partly in response to stuff that came up last week, I thought it might be fun to show a simple model of a plume. And so this is some work that Scott King and I did in the early 90s. And the geometry here is axisymmetric. And what you're seeing is a very simple model. So this is a spherical axisymmetric geometry. The axis of symmetry is down here. We're not looking at the entire globe. Actually, this cutoff is a graphical problem. But basically, you can see the size. We're looking at this small thing. So actually, the domain of calculation is sort of this to this to this. It's a little wedge. And then the way to read one of these is to imagine spinning this around the central axis to sweep out an umbrella shape. And that's what that's kind of what you see. There is, although you can't see it so well in this temperature scheme, there's there has to be a return flow going down the side. And so if you spin that around the central axis, you see that you get a kind of, you do get an umbrella. You get a kind of umbrella shape in this. And that's one of the pitfalls of axisymmetry. Okay, let's see if I can figure out how to stop this in the middle. Okay. So what we've done in this very simple model is, and just to try and understand the dynamics of plumes, is that we have the boundary here extends down like that in the spherical geometry, and we've heated a patch on the bottom here. We've just heated a little patch because all we wanted to do was generate a plume. Now, you saw the classic experiment last week of a injected hot material and being injected into a colder syrup in a laboratory, and you saw the development of a plume coming up. And so essentially what this model was designed to do is to try and understand what the controls were on that. And it turns out that one of the most important controls is actually the viscosity contrast between this material and the material in the plume. So in this case, we have a pretty strongly temperature-dependent viscosity. And what happens is that, first of all, this hot patch develops, and it develops gradually a boundary layer, a hot boundary layer. Eventually, the buoyancy forces in that boundary layer become so large that they overcome the resistance to flow that's given by the fact that the material over here is more viscous, and so this boundary layer becomes unstable, and the instability starts to rise, and that's the kind of classic onset of convection. You saw that in 2D in your tutorial. You saw the onset of convection. You saw that giant boundary layer develop, and then the thing overturned very suddenly because it was so hot or cold. The top one was cold. So this is starting to rise. Now, in this case, because the viscosity depends rather strongly on temperature, I think there's a factor of 1,000 contrast between this hot material and the coldest material. So it's not a hugely large dependence, but it's large enough. So what happens is this blob comes up here and it hits some viscous resistance, and so it slows down. And then, but the material behind it has a conduit to go through. And so the material behind it basically comes up through that conduit and gets stalled here. It's like a traffic jam in the mantle. So those of you who drove yesterday can relate to that. So basically, it's a little traffic jam here and that builds up material. And so this plume head becomes larger and larger as it grows. It also cools a little bit, and it's cooling in part because it's mixing in material from the surrounding mantle into the plume head. So the path for material is to come up here and then kind of hit that resistance and get spread out to the side and then circulate internally. And so that's the classic mushroom cloud. I don't have an animation of this, but if we had an isoviscous plume, the plume would look rather boring. It would just look like a boundary layer instability like that. And if we had a plume that was more viscous than the overlying mantle, now why would we have that? Well, we probably wouldn't have that in the Earth, but it's just an interesting exercise to look at. What you would end up with is actually more of a balloon shape. So this is basically, the plume is more viscous than the matrix. And here we have isoviscous. And this is where the plume is less viscous than the surrounding matrix. So you can get different geometries depending on the viscosity contrast. The viscosity contrast plays a really big, important role in this. And so understanding that temperature dependence and how it varies with depth would actually be very handy to understanding the dynamics the dynamics of plumes. I think it basically injects itself into, what's the force balance that leads to that? That's a good question. I think basically the plume itself has a difficult time moving because it's so viscous. So it tends to stall sort of internally and tends to rise. It moves as a single body. Yeah. And then stuff will slightly feed that. Did you say surface tension? But actually, this is something that, I don't know how well you guys can see this actually back there, but this is something that has been shown primarily in experiments. People haven't really done this so much in these numerical things, and so there may actually be surface tension in some in the syrup experiments that were done to generate these kinds of things. So surface tension may actually play an effect, but it will not play an effect in the mantle. Okay, let's see what I have next. Oh, this is just very quickly. Okay, so the plume that I just generated, you're going to see, you should recognize that there are some sort of flaws in this. For one thing, this is really big. So I don't think, well, I don't know, probably could see that seismically, right? I mean, something that gigantic, maybe it would be visible. Okay, so this is 3,000 kilometers, so it's, you know, I mean, across here, it's thousands of kilometers. And across here, it's maybe, I don't know, a few hundred kilometers, something like that. So it's a pretty big whopping thing, and that's because basically this is a relatively low Rayleigh number. Also, our surrounding mantle is not very hot. So this is a plume basically emerging into a kind of coolish mantle in order to study the dynamics of plumes themselves. So having written papers about plumes myself, I can say this hopefully without insulting anybody, but basically, I think you should approach any paper that models plumes with a healthy skepticism, because essentially, in order to get this kind of clean dynamical picture, you have to do things like I just said. You have to basically start out with a mantle that's not moving very much to begin with, and that's not likely to be the picture that we're dealing with in the Earth. And so, so this sort of coolish mantle here is allowing us to generate this beautiful plume head, which is very similar to the tank experiments and so on. And actually relating this to what is happening in the Earth that has evolved over time dynamically is a much more complex and interesting question. Okay, so when you read a plume paper, any dynamical paper actually, you should ask yourself what assumptions went into it. Actually, it's probably true for anything in our field, right? It's not restricted to dynamics papers. So this is work by Ribby and Christensen and Ribby, in which they are trying to then look at the effect near the surface of a plate moving over the plume. They have a similar sort of model. It's higher resolution because this was done a few years after we did our work, but it's also injecting the plume from below, so in order to generate a plume. Because they're trying to understand the interaction of a plume when it comes up to the plate, they wanted to control where the plume is, and that's a fair way to approach it. And so they basically injected this plume and then created a moving boundary on the surface that shows you the kind of parabolic pattern that you get. As the plume material is spreading out, it's also being carried away from that point source and giving us a nice thermal anomaly that extends over time. And by then calculating, I think I showed this last week, by then basically looking at what the potential temperatures in that plume are, you can then make some sort of estimate of what the melt might be in a situation like this. And that would be interesting to, that's interesting to understand. Well, that must have been the early stage of this model, because it had to start like that. I don't happen to know offhand if they looked at that, because they were interested in looking at the more mature plume. Could you reword that question?
You know, from the previous picture.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah, it's been carried away.
Right.
It's been carried off out there.
I've never seen a model where it was actually still there. Where you actually describing the
Okay, so the question was whether there are any models of the intersection of the early stage of the plume with the lithosphere that that show the interaction of that. Let's see. Sorry? Yeah, I'm trying to think of a specific one that would answer that question exactly. Okay. I mean, certainly this has been studied fairly extensively. Okay, just very briefly, some heat sources in the interior, the current heat sources. We have some, basically right now, there is heat left over from the formation of the planet and from differentiation of the core, and that's coming out. So there is, that's sort of known as secular cooling, I guess. And so then there's also decay happening in the interior of the Earth. So these are the primary current heat sources, uranium, thorium, and potassium. And I believe we're going to hear about isotope systematics later, a little bit more. These daughter elements come into play, 206, 207, 208 lead, and argon 40. And there's, I should have put helium out there as a helium 4 as a byproduct of all this stuff. Half-lives range from basically the age of the Earth, that's a nice convenient half-life, to something less than that, to something more than that. And here's just a table of production of heat. This is available from some textbooks. This is microwatts per kilogram of uranium, not per kilogram of rock. Okay, so these are in the Earth in smallish quantities when it comes to producing heat, but because the Earth is so big, they produce a lot of heat in aggregate. So you don't have to write all these numbers down because they'll be available to you. But those are the kind of main heat sources. Now, okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about where the heat might be, and I think probably what I say will be some people won't like, some people will like it, but we'll just kind of discuss it a little bit. So going back to the global heat budget, we have that 44 terawatts, and probably one of the best sources is Stein in one of the AGU monographs. But there are several papers by Carol Stein and also by Carol Stein and Seth Stein about this. Now, the question is how much of that heat is being currently produced in the mantle and how much of that heat is being produced, is basically left over from the formation of the Earth or is related to cooling of the Earth. And there are several kind of summaries that indicate that the bulk, the sort of overall heat production in the Earth currently should be in the range of 20 terawatts. Okay, so we heard a little bit about this last week about the composition of the Earth and about the controversies associated with the overall composition of the Earth, and those come into play in coming up with this number. So I'm not sure of what uncertainties I would put on this number from cosmochemistry at this point, but there would be some large uncertainties on this number.
No. Or is that just the radiogenic?
This is just radiogenic. Okay. So the 44 terawatts there is now just there for your reference. So you have something to relate the other numbers to. So the 20 terawatts here, and these bars here are proportional to those numbers for a visual kind of reference as well. So, okay, so 20 terawatts, let's just say for fun. Then we might want to ask, where is that heat? And because of processes associated, because the heat-producing elements are incompatible, they like to go into the crust, and so they have landed to a large extent in the continental crust. Actually, to an extraordinary extent. So, you know, half maybe is in the continental crust, even though the continental crust is volumetrically just a minuscule part of the Earth. But it's very good at attracting and keeping the heat-producing elements. You'll notice that, so this is just from various sources in the literature, and there may be other sources as well. of information about this. But basically, this number is very hard to constrain. It goes from 5.6 to 12. I'm probably 5. Probably the 0.6 is optimistic. Probably it should be like 5 to 12 or something. So and that's partly because, well, the continental crust is so heterogeneous, and it's partly because we don't really have a very good handle on the composition of the lower crust. But various people have done systematic studies where they look at different rock types, different just sort of look at the continents in general, and have kind of summarized this in this way. So if about half of the heat is being produced in the continental crust, that means the rest of the heat is being produced somewhere else, the mantle or the core, and that leaves behind a question of, is that okay? I mean, do we understand where that heat is? So we know that the source of MORB is depleted, and it's possible to estimate from from the sorts of things that we heard about on Saturday what the depleted source might look like. And let's imagine that the entire volume of the mantle has the same concentration of heat-producing elements as the MORB source. That can produce something like 2 to 7 terawatts. And again, there's a fair amount of uncertainty on this based on, again, models of what the source region ought to look like and other considerations. But the thing that's the problem, maybe or may not be a problem, depending on what uncertainties you want to put on all these numbers, is that these two numbers don't add up to this number. And at the high end, they may be due. At the high end of 7 terawatts in the mantle and 12 terawatts in the crust, they almost do. But at the low end, they don't. And so this leaves us actually with a little bit of a gap, perhaps a very small gap, which could then be absorbed into the uncertainties, but perhaps a very large gap, which would create a problem with the overall heat budget. If we have to produce 5 or 9 terawatts somewhere in the Earth, not in the crust and not in the depleted mantle, we have a little bit of a problem. So this has led to very lively discussion about where that heat ought to be, or whether we even have a need for such a heat source. One possibility is to stuff it into the core. And in general, the core doesn't seem to like these sorts of materials. And so essentially, it seems unlikely that there's a very large amount of heat producing elements in the core. But on the other hand, the core might be able to take little bits of a lot of stuff, and it's also pretty big. So another possibility is a mantle reservoir of some sort. And I think my next figure is going to show you a bunch of cartoons. No, not quite. Let me just go to the cartoons here. Okay, so this is sort of one of the arguments that leads to this kind of discussion, these kinds of cartoons, the menagerie of models, in which the orange, okay, not the core orange stuff, but the kind of paler orange stuff is presumably contains some of this extra heat production. And depending on what else you bring to this problem, you might actually think of this as the entire lower mantle, or you might think of it as being somehow distributed in the mantle, either uniformly distributed in the mantle or concentrated in some part of the mantle, or you might think of it as being in the lower mantle, either in a big layer like this or in a thinner layer like D double prime, something like that. But all of those things have been put into play in part to account for for this heat production problem, and in part to account for some other kind of questions that people have. Okay, so the cosmochemistry is one way to constrain the heat production, and another way to think about it is actually to think about how the mantle might have evolved over time. So I'm not going to, again, go into really great detail about this, but I did want to mention a point that I think sometimes gets forgotten about the mantle, which is that the mantle's kind of self-regulating in a sense. So so basically, I showed you the variation of the full convection equations, but if we just wanted to look at the change in temperature of the mantle as a whole with time, we might want to write an equation that's something like this. That's the mass of the mantle, the heat capacity, the change in temperature, average temperature with time, is going to depend on the heat production and the heat flow. A is the surface area, Q is the heat flow. And we can use this sort of simple model to try and understand the evolution of the temperature through time. And then we have to take into account the fact that the heat production decays with time because heat is being produced by radioactive decay, and so those things will change. There's less heat production now than there was 3 billion years ago. 3 billion years ago, there was probably twice as much heat production as there is now, and so on. That's even without accounting for the extraction of heat into the continent. And we also have to take into account the viscosity. So you can do some very nice, elegant models, and actually I have some references on the bottom here from 1965 and then from 1980 and from 2003. So this is a problem that recurs quite often. The fact that some of these papers are from the 60s tells you that you can actually get pretty far with these one-dimensional models without having a computer at all, right? There were no finite element models for these guys to work with. They had to work with the basic math. But the principles are rather straightforward. So as the mantle heats up, the viscosity drops because of this. As the viscosity drops, the convection moves more rapidly. That more rapid convection is going to pull heat out of the mantle more rapidly. That will cause the mantle to cool. So more rapid convection will cool the mantle. As the mantle cools, the viscosity will drop again. Thus, according to this equation, and then as the viscosity will increase in the cooler mantle, that will slow down the convection, which will cause the heat to build up again. So essentially, the mantle is self-regulating in terms of its possible range of viscosities and sort of heat loss. And that's actually very convenient for us and has some interesting consequences. You can actually try this out for yourself using the sitcom model that we showed. If you put in a temperature, I wouldn't go to a too extreme temperature dependent viscosity because you may have some resolution problems in the hot boundary layer. But if you put in a moderate temperature dependent viscosity, you can play around with things. You'll see the heating up. You'll see all this stuff happen. So essentially rearranging this equation so that we get the change in temperature with time, we can relate the change in temperature with time to this number called the Urey ratio, which is basically a measure of the amount of heat being generated to the amount of heat being lost. And that's the number that we want to know. And if you play that game, this is a schematic of this sort of model. If you play that game, you can get you can generate a plot of temperature versus time, and as you might expect, it's going to generally decay. The average temperature of the mantle is going to decay with time. And I borrowed this from Dave Stevenson. So it shows the change with time, and then there's some other things happening when you do or don't include plates. There have been different curves, some of which actually even have a different curvature, so they don't decay in this sense, they decay in this sense. But in general, if you back up the temperature, at some point you'll discover that if we have not very much heat production now, if you back up that temperature, you're going to end up with a mantle that's really, really, really hot in the early stages, maybe even partially molten in the Archean or something like that. And you quickly get to a fairly unacceptably hot mantle in the first billion years or billion and a half years of the planet. And so that has actually led some people to estimate that the amount of heat production in the mantle has got to be not so much half of the bulk of the global heat flow, but actually as much as 70% of the bulk heat flow. So if I stretched this out so that it was up here, 30 terawatts or something like that, it's going to create even more of a problem for us in terms of where the heat production is happening. So this is an argument that sometimes gets overlooked in this discussion, but it's something that has to be addressed because of the basically self-regulating nature of mantle convection. Okay, and that's enough of that. Oh, gosh, okay. Debating. I'll just run through this somewhat quickly. A couple of years ago, Sylvain Ferrechat and I tried to look at this. It's actually a vexing problem because of all the uncertainties. And we just looked at sort of what the normalized, what the heat production might be as a function. We went back to those diagrams of the orange, you know, where I had the orange blobs and the orange layer and so on. And we said, how big a layer do you need, or how much of a volume or mass, actually, do you need of the mantle to account for the missing heat? And it was a vexing problem in part because if we wanted to use a chondritic mantle, we couldn't easily incorporate the uncertainties in the chondritic mantle production into this. So we basically decided that the thing that was the best constraint, believe it or not, was the composition of the depleted mantle. I'm open to suggestions of improvements of this because it's definitely got some difficulties here. And so we called our hot reservoir the L, and then looked at the normalized heat production that would be required in that as a function of the mass of that L. And this just represents those very large uncertainties in all of the where the heat production might be. So and this is on the logarithmic scale here, so that's definitely a problem. And then we put on there some things like MORB. And we assumed that MORB was, I guess it's 8 or something, has a factor of 8 enrichment compared to the depleted mantle that it originates from. And we put on there bulk silicate earth with some uncertainties on that. We did not take into account those parameterized convection estimates of the bulk silicate heat production. So that's based purely on the range available from cosmochemistry at the time that we did this, about 3 or 4 years ago. And so then we also basically put on some favorite boundaries, some favorite hypothetical boundaries, some real boundaries. So 670 is real, that would be there. And this would basically be the situation if the entire lower mantle were had the extra heat production, and the entire upper mantle was the depleted reservoir. And this is actually kind of a nice set of intersections here because it doesn't require that the lower mantle be excessively wildly enriched compared to anything else, but it just requires that it be almost in the bulk silicate earth range. If we put all the excess heat in D double prime, on the other hand, down here, we get a little bit of a problem because it's so hot it would have to be super enriched compared to the rest of the mantle. Although it could be, you can just barely get an overlap here because of this wide range of where we could just say that D double prime is all leftover oceanic crust that had been recycled. And that's also true for some sort of intermediate layer of you know, maybe 1,000 kilometers depth or something. So there's a lot of there's a lot of kind of ways to play with that. Okay. So just a couple minutes on this. This is basically to remind all of us that we actually have that we tend to want to go for sort of smooth models of evolution of the Earth with time. But the Earth doesn't necessarily evolve smoothly with time. It's actually time dependent. And so this was a compilation done by a colleague of mine that an attempt to reconstruct what the mantle might have looked like to generate various episodes of plate collision and extension, and his summary of the essentially the plate structures over time for, I guess, a billion years or so. Of course, it gets a little vaguer as you get back further in time. But essentially, what I just wanted to remind you is that the Earth is very time dependent and has lots of time dependent factors in it. In fact, you might consider, okay, so this is now a very simple model of convection. I don't think this represents the Earth, but it's a very simple model. And it's designed to try and show you a couple of things about time dependence. So basically, what this is a simple model in which the mantle is internally heated, and I've put some tracer particles in there, so you're going to be able to see some evolution of the tracer particles. We can see these are not really subduction zones; these are downwellings, simple downwellings, but they consolidate. The mantle could actually be thought of as a chaotic system, and I mean chaotic in the formal mathematical sense of the chaos theory. There are enough nonlinearities in those convection equations to generate a nonlinear behavior. And so we've been attempting a little bit to understand that behavior, partly by understanding the evolution of tracers. So this is one way of trying to integrate geochemical observations with geophysical observations by putting in tracers. And Peter has done an extensive amount of work on using chemical tracers to try and understand the chemical evolution of the Earth, and done some very interesting work along those lines. Several other people have as well. So one thing you can see is the formation in this kind of model of various structures. The particles started out at the intersection of those two arrows right about there, and now they're spread out throughout this entire thing. There's a wraparound boundary condition, so any particle that goes out that side pops into this side. Any packet of fluid that does that pops into this side. One thing you see over time is that, depending on your point of view, this is either very well mixed or not very well mixed. So we have a pretty wide distribution of particles locally, but not so much globally. There's a lot of lateral variation in there, and that's quite intriguing. Okay. All right. Don't want to dwell on that too much. Oh, I did want to dwell on this a bit, a minute. I just want to mention this a minute. I mentioned that the mantle is chaotic. And I really like this work by Farishad and Ricard, in which, because it's so simple. They basically took a box. This is not solving the full thermal convection equations. It's basically a kinematic flow. They took a three-dimensional box, and they put a plate on. They put two plates on the top, and they put a little plate boundary with a little offset there. And then they moved that one that direction, and that one that direction, and they generated steady state. There's no time dependence in this steady state flow. And then they dropped two tracer particles in there, and they colored one red, and they colored one blue. And depending on where they drop them, they get these phenomenally different paths, which is quite interesting to me. So because in two dimensions. If you do work in two dimensions, the particle paths will be a closed path like this. This is a closed path in 3D, or an almost closed path in 3D. But in three dimensions, you can get very complicated, chaotic paths, very difficult to look at. In fact, if you didn't see this thing on the left, you might think that there would be no pockets anywhere in this that would be preserved. One way to present this is to look at what's called a Poincaré section, which is basically a slice through there. I'm not sure where this slice must have been taken, more or less along here, I think. Oh, wait, X and Z. Okay, so it's a slice in the middle. It's a slice at the halfway point, or maybe close to the top. And every time the path crosses through that slice, they put a point down. So this is a way of mapping the points here, and mapping that path in a way that allows you to see the different regimes more clearly than you can see in these boxes. And so you can see this nice kind of closed path here, and the nice little area around it. The blue particles are not traveling everywhere. They're only traveling in these limited areas. And probably if you put a particle there, or maybe there, you would see a similar closed path. So you see pockets, and you also see chaos, essentially. Very interesting. Okay, I'm going to skip some of this stuff, even though it's pretty. Because I wanted to end with a planetary perspective, okay? So here are some planets, ours, the one we're interested in, and then a few other kind of quasi-Earth-like planets. So that's Mercury, that's Venus, that's Mars. And so these are the pictures you see all the time. And then NASA has generated these nice handy cross-sections. So there's the Earth with the core in proportion and the inner core in proportion. And Mercury, as you can see, Mercury's kind of cool because there's a mission heading there now. So we know virtually nothing about it right now, and we'll know a lot about it in a few years. But it's got a very large core, and Mars and Venus have cores that are, you know, not totally out of scale with the scale of our core. Okay, and Venus in particular is only a little bit smaller than the Earth. Now, why am I mean, we're talking about the transition zone. Why am I bringing in these other planets? The reason I'm bringing them in is because as scientists, if you were trained in sort of the scientific method, you learn about doing multiple experiments and so on, and medical researchers will say that an experiment on one mouse is not an experiment. You need lots of mice to do the experiment. But we only have one mouse, right? We have our own Earth to experiment on, and that's basically more or less all we have, except that we have some neighboring planets that should obey the same rules of physics and chemistry as are followed on Earth and have some superficial resemblance to the Earth. And so we might expect that they would have similar types of processes, right? They have heat generation, probably, I mean, I don't know about Mercury, but probably for these, not so far different from the amount of heat being generated in the interior of our planet. And they have had volcanism, and so they probably have mantle convection because you have to get the heat out. The heat has to come out, so it's got to come out in some way, and the way it comes out on these planets is by mantle convection. So, but as it turns out, they look very different in not just superficially like this, but when you start to look at whether they have plate tectonics, they look very differently, and this actually leads us to a question of why we luckily have plate tectonics and Mars and Venus don't have exactly what we have. They don't have big spreading centers, they don't have quite the same kind of structure or dynamics. So there's been a fair amount of work done on this, and some of it has to do with looking at the interiors of these planets from the point of view of a heat engine and doing things like playing with the convection equations and playing especially with the viscosity contrast. So the viscosity appears to play a very, very big role in this. Whoops, there's a missing x-axis here. This should be the log of the Rayleigh number. Some fashion. So what you're seeing here is a kind of phase space, I guess, of viscosity and Rayleigh number. So in everything we've taught you so far, as the Rayleigh number goes up, convection should become more vigorous. But when we have very strong, when we have a very strong viscosity contrast, we can basically suppress that by putting a plate on the surface that isn't mobile and therefore doesn't let the heat out. This is going to lead to some problems because, as I mentioned, when you prevent the heat from coming out, the interior ought to heat up, the viscosity should reduce, the heat will come out. The heat must come out. So we can end up with these very interesting range of behaviors, even no convection in some large range. That's not a very interesting range, so we're interested in these ranges in which, for instance, we might have a stagnant lid. In the stagnant lid case, that probably applies right now to Venus. Basically, there's only one plate, and it's just sitting there, not mobile. And then, but as heat builds up, the viscosity will drop, and you might end up with rapid overturns over time. So this can be summarized like this. It's another borrowing from petrology to make a dynamics figure. In which basically the three ways of getting heat out of the interior of a planet, the three primary ways, are put as endpoints on this triangle, and then we've made an attempt to drop the planets, some of the planetary bodies on there in some way. So the Earth is primarily working by plate recycling, and that basically means that we have a mobile lid that is broken into plates, and as those plates circulate into the interior, their job, from the point of view of dynamics, is to cool the mantle. That's their job. And so they are doing that and putting the Earth out here in this corner. On another extreme, the Moon and probably Mercury are behaving primarily by conduction. The Moon's crust has been frozen in time for billions of years, very, very, very little happening to it. And so it's sitting there and conducting heat out. There may be some internal convection. You know, it's possible that the interior of the Moon is heating up over time, currently. Sarah would probably have an opinion about that. I don't know. So it's possible that the interior of the Moon is currently... Do you? Oh, sorry, I was like, look, scanning out. You're sitting right in front of it. I don't know. You've thought about this a little bit, I think. So it's possible that the interior of the Moon is heating up, but maybe not. The Mars probably falls into this category right now. Its surface is very stable right now, but it may have had a complicated history. And so there's a curve drawn here, a speculative curve, which starts out with plate recycling. It's been proposed that there was plate tectonics early on in the history of this planet, and then goes through a sort of hotspot-dominated volcanism, and then tends towards a very simple picture now of lithosphere conduction. Venus probably goes through this dramatic, very dramatic and very chaotic alternate regimes in which it's it moves to plate recycling, then moves to lithospheric conduction. It's kind of the extreme of what I was talking about, where when it's in the regime of lithospheric conduction, it's dominated by that's where somewhere like where it is right now. There's not much happening on the surface, and then the interior heats up so much because it's such a big planet that it overturns all at once. The whole plate, the whole surface gets recycled into the interior all at once, cooling the mantle down very dramatically. And the Earth is not quite so dramatic about these things. Io, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, is dominated by hotspot volcanism. We don't know very much about the interior of that, so it's kind of on there just to, so that something's at that corner. Mars has may or may not have a transition zone. If it does have a transition zone, it probably is in the lowermost 200 kilometers of the Martian mantle. Okay, now I don't remember the exact radius of Mars, but previous one was in proportion. That's in proportion. So Mars is pretty small. So we don't know exactly the size of the core of Mars. So it may be that the transition sort of through the equivalent of the transition zone that happens in 660 on the Earth happens just above the core mantle boundary of Mars. And that depends a little bit on whether the Martian core is big or small. And if there is a transition zone, there have been numerical models that suggest that will organize the flow into plumes, into a few, maybe even just one, giant plume, because of the effect of the phase transition on buoyancy and other things. And so that leads us to these sorts of planets. So because I might have shown that first and ask you to tell me what you think the differences are. Okay, those are the sort of nice glossy pictures of the planets. And then these are maps of topography for Earth, Venus, and Mars. The Earth has this nice bimodal distribution of topography with continents sticking above sea level and ocean basins below sea level. Venus has a remarkably uniform topography. Even when you see beautiful flybys of Martian volcanoes, those have huge vertical exaggeration. Venus doesn't have the sort of continental signature that the Earth does. And Mars has this very curious thing, which is you can almost draw a line across the hemisphere, and the whole southern hemisphere is elevated, with the exception of this big whopping hole and another hole here. And the whole northern hemisphere is depressed, with the exception of the part of the Thoris Rise here that sticks into the northern hemisphere. So there's something here about Mars that has organized itself into two distinct hemispheres with two very distinct topographic signatures, and that has to do with the interior. That large plume, that's Olympus Mons, that may be right there, may have been right there. Okay, let me just end with that. So I think I'll end with that. So end with basically Olympus Mons compared in scale, on the same scale, to Hawaii. So you can see one giant shield volcano, and then Hawaii. It gets you a sense of the scale of that, too. So that would be an interesting thing to explain. And so bringing that back to the Earth, basically, if we can understand the transition zone in the Earth, we can then basically try and carry that to other planets, but it may also be worthwhile to investigate a little bit what's going on in these other planets and see if we can extrapolate, have multiple mice in our experiment, and gain some insight into the Earth from that. Okay, let me stop there. Thanks. That took more time than I thought.
When people model these sorts of analysis processes, we have an opinion about the antiquity of specific spaces. The Earth is sort of segmented in half, like Mars is segmented in half. You rotate it so that the ocean is up and down.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I don't know. It gets harder to say when you get further back in time. Alan. Yeah. Well, no, right. They're not going to go back and forth in the same orientation, the same direction, or the same configuration, obviously. Right. Right. Oops. Oh yeah, I think there probably have been times. Wait. To do that? But so I mean, by the Pacific, do you mean where it is now? Or do you mean that there has been some ocean basin somewhere? Or more, right? I mean, if the continents are growing slowly, then it would be more than that. If 2 billion years ago there was, you know, less continental crust, you might even have more than that. I don't know. This goes back to Rodinia. So this goes back, you know, 1 billion years, and then it gets kind of dashed. So this is a tectonicist's view of that. And you have a series, and I think for all of this time you would have pretty large ocean basins, actually. In fact, you can't really see it very well, but let's see. This only goes back to 250 million years, but basically there's a giant, you know, more than half the Earth when Pangaea is formed, is a giant ocean basin. So a very large part of the Earth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You also point out that in the Earth and Mars, the potential commonality that we all have is the one with a better word to call the geo planet.
Yes, maybe.
I wonder if people have thought about taking Venus into that story. We don't really know much about Venus, except that it's smaller, and maybe it's small enough so it doesn't have.
That's a really good question. Okay, so Tom's question was about it was basically making the analogy that essentially the transition in the lower mantle of Mars, if it occurs, is equivalent to D double prime on the Earth. And the question is, does Venus have a D double prime? I don't know of a person who's calculated that, but that doesn't mean it isn't out there. My guess is that that hasn't really been looked at, actually. So Venus is a little bit smaller, and wouldn't that inhibit the post-perovskite? Yeah. How much would such a calculation depend on knowing, how sensitive would it be to the composition of the mantle of Venus? And temperature. Yeah. So that's going to be a little bit tricky because Venus doesn't have a continental crust. It's
For density,
it's probably okay. Yeah.
And you don't have a type of core in Venus. All you can do is assume it's
like. Yeah, that's right. You can assume it's proportional to the Earth and similar in composition. Yeah, you could do that. I don't know that that's been done. Yes. Yes. Right. Why not do the whole derivation in mass units? that get you into trouble? No, I don't know that that would. Peter's laughing, so he has an opinion about this. No obvious pitfalls. Do you want to comment? You do get uglier equations, yes. Yes, it fits on one slide. Avoid a lot of messiness. I'm not sure how to answer that question. Are the messy parts equal? Yeah. Probably the compressible equations are going to be somewhat messy anyway. They may not be as bad if you do them in messiness. Oh, okay, yeah, these are funny looking. So, okay, so these are Eldridge, who works on the tectonics and basically has done these reconstructions, asked me about whether it would be possible to put a layer in the lower mantle at about the time that I was thinking about that anyway. And so he basically tried to look at what's happening. These are compressed in this, they are collapsed, shall we say, from the entire sphere to a slice. So these funny intersections of slabs are, one slab is probably on one side of the planet and the other slab is somewhere else. But they've been collapsed to show all of the slabs, all of the downwellings that might have existed during this particular time. So they look funny from that point of view. So basically what we did is drew essentially what was going on at the surface, and then filled in the subduction zones, and then just extended them down, but in this kind of compressed, in this kind of collapsed way. So I wouldn't treat that as real. I would treat that as two subduction zones that are going in opposite directions, that are far enough away that they're not actually bumping into each other. Probably we should, you know, try drawing this on a rotating Earth, and then. And you'd be able to see it a little better. Is that why you were asking?
Well, the number of subduction zones.
Yeah. So.
That's
what he thinks. Yeah, that's right. That's what Eldridge thinks. So essentially, 250 million years. So basically, there's Pangaea, and it's about to start breaking up, and so you have all these subduction zones. So yeah. So that's exactly right. And then you move to a little later, and they kind of die out a little bit, and basically things start to heat up again a little bit because there's less subduction cooling the mantle. And then as a result of that, you get large-scale superplumes, which are then coming up to the surface and looking like what he calls the superplume epoch, starting about 100 million years ago. And that would be sort of continuing to today, with those being then, got them located right, one in the Pacific and one under the Atlantic, which might be sort of under Africa. So that would have continued in some mode till now. And that's based entirely on a reconstruction of the plate, where the plates were. I think that's meant to be time. So essentially, that's associated with this. So the large igneous province bar is during the time of breakup of Pangaea. When you have a lot of subduction zones, you also have a lot of spreading centers, and so then you may end up with a lot of large igneous provinces, and that would lead into this sort of superplume epoch. And the same is true. Yeah. It's just before Ravinia. Yes. Right. I don't know the basis of that. It's based on a study of ophiolites, but I don't know the specifics of where that comes from. There's an association between the breakup and subduction. That there's an association in time. Basically, the whole system has more overturn in association with the breakup, and that's going to be associated with more subduction, just more activity in general. more plate boundaries, basically, of all types. Okay. If there are no other questions, time for coffee.